You're listening to an audio recording of Doug McElroy's November 3rd, 2005 presentation to the Dartmouth Lake Sunapee Linux User Group and the Greater New Hampshire Linux User Group entitled Ancestry of Linux, How the Fun Began. A link to a video of this presentation can be found at our website, blslug.org.
Presentation's going to go for a little over an hour. Doug McElroy, he's currently a professor of computer science here at Dartmouth. He has a long history of contributions to the Unix community. For one, he was the head of the team that developed Unix at Bell Labs. So, and he also came up with the idea of software componentry and wrote lots of neat little Unix tools that we all use as software components still today. So without further ado, I'll have Doug up to correct my introduction and give a presentation.
Thank you, Mark. Well, the first real computers went into use while I was in high school. And fairly soon after I got to college at Cornell, Cornell got his first machine, which was this guy, the CPC. Consisted of these four boxes. The one in the middle is a printer and a card reader. The one in front on the right is a card punch. The one in the back is the computer proper. And the one on the left is the memory. Any guesses to how much memory it had? That box held 24 10 decimal digit words. This machine is not a computer. This is notice it's called a calculator, and that's correct. It was an automated desk calculator. The instructions came in from punched cards. And if you needed a loop, you stood in front of the machine, had the cards at the top, took them out of the bottom, and put them back on the top.
So a branch would be, you decided...
It did have a branch instruction.
Okay.
It did have a branch instruction. The cards had a left half and a right half. And you could conditionally go to the stream of instructions on the left or the stream of instructions on the right. I actually got one fairly substantial program to work on that machine. Well, it runs instructions at best at the card reader rate, which was 150 cards a minute. Instructions were big floating point instructions, though. They were four arithmetic operations and all of the elementary functions, sine, cosine, exponential. Every time you hit one of those, the card reader stopped for 10 seconds. It's actually based on, and this thing is actually a marvel. If you look at old radios, you know the vacuum tubes are something about this big, and they're very hot, and inside of a radio like this, you had three of them. This vacuum tube is tiny. This is the end of the line in vacuum tube development, and they've gotten them down real small, and it has several different anode cathode pairs within the one housing. And essentially all the vacuum tubes are on that one drawer. Big, heavy swinging drawer. It really is a marvel of packaging. It was designed for, designed for commercial data processing. And commercial data processing was all done with plug boards. You would, you and also the ENIAC calculator from mid-40s was a plug-board machine. If you wanted to add two numbers, you said, you plug the output of this register to the input of that register. This machine had a general purpose plug board that was plugged up to make an interpreter of the instruction set that I learned. I knew that there were much nicer machines around. There had been a very nice book written by Ed Berkeley called Giant Brains or Machines That Think. And it was sort of the first good popular book about computing. And it had all kinds of wild predictions that have more or less come true now. That everybody will have his address list on a piece of magnetic tape. Fortunately, the magnetic tape is gone. Of course, there were all these predictions, too, about chess playing. And that didn't happen for a long time. When I graduated from Cornell, I went to the MIT because they had sort of the biggest machine that was available in the public sector at the time. And that was Whirlwind. You walked into the Whirlwind control room, and it's straight out of the movies. Nice, indirect, dim light, lots of flashing red indicators, and CRTs all over the place. The primary output of this machine was graphic. It did have a printer, but the printer was so much slower than microfilm that everybody took any serious output on microfilm had it developed. It was about 1 hour turnaround time. This gadget over here is Interactive Graphic Workstation in 1952. Only a few people got to use that because the machine was fast. It had a 12 microsecond cycle time. Most jobs took a matter of a few minutes. And when you were doing interactive graphics, you tied up the machine. So a few lucky people could get up at 3 a.m. and do interactive graphics. But it is from this machine that Doug Ross put together the first numerically controlled milling machine programs. Whirlwind was actually built as a test bed for the SAGE early warning system. And one of the things that was tested here was core memory. This is the first machine that had it. And this is a 32 by 32 matrix of magnetic cores. The memory itself had a stack of 16 of those. They took a whole relay rack, standard 19-inch rack, and a little higher than I am, for 2K of memory. And that was infinite. It was really big at 24. The real wonder of the machine, though, is this. Oh, nope. Sir. This is in the display station and also but principally on the SAGE early warning system. Were these things called paratrons? This is a cathode ray tube. It has buried in the middle of it a mask with all the letters of the alphabet. And this made it very fast for displaying alphanumerics. You ran the electron beam deflected the electron beam through the correct character, and then back to the screen. And you could also do point plotting as well as character plotting. This thing actually survived in use for well over a decade. They were on a Strömberg Carlson machines that were made in the 1960s. But now the real wonder. That is the CPU. Each one of these relay racks is one bit of the accumulator. You could go in there and count them up, 16 of them. The machine was very fast, and it was three stories high. In the cellar was where the motor generators were creating DC. On the first floor were the power supplies, and on the second floor was the control room, and then you could walk back through the CPU. Beautiful diagnostic techniques. Every morning for an hour, the engineers would take the machine down and run marginal tests on it. Marginal test is where you crank up the voltage and you crank the voltage down, so all stressing all the components, and hopefully they would fail during morning test and not during ordinary use. And I can tell you from experience that this machine failed in ordinary use far less than the subsequent IBM machines that I used. It really did work. Interestingly enough, even though I had two stories full of vacuum tubes, there were only 3,000 of them. And really quite a careful design. Whereas ENIAC, which had preceded it, had, as I recall, in excess of 12,000. One hears occasionally stories about, back in those early days, you programmed in binary. Not so. This machine had an assembler right from the start, and it had a slightly higher level language, higher than C but lower than Fortran, that was that went into use in 1952. Rarely used, most people used machine language because machine language was small. It had an operating system. The operating system did manage secondary memory, which was a drum. It did I/O, and it had a floating point interpreter in it. The operators actually would load each job into a paper tape reader separately, but the operators spent no time pushing buttons on the machine. The operating system did it. And it was a real surprise when in 1956, MIT got a machine, a 704 from IBM. And there was no operating system. The MIT, having had one already, made sure that they built one before the machine came in. But the operating system didn't make a very good home for Fortran. Stan, did you ever see a Fortran stop book? Or was that gone before your day?
Stop?
Fortran, as she first came from IBM, had lots of diagnostics in it, properly. And the way the diagnostics were issued was it stopped, and the operator read the holding address off the console lights and reported it. And then there was a big listing stop book. And you would take it, that number, and go look it up in the listing. And it would say something like, overflow of the tag table or some other trouble. Nevertheless, Fortran really changed life when it did. It made computing accessible to the masses. When I left MIT. Let me tell one more MIT story. One time, probably around 1957, a bunch of us were sitting around the room, and one person said, "What would it mean if a, what would happen if one's, if a subroutine called itself?" And I don't know, but I see how to program it. Several of us simultaneously saw that you could use the index registers and make a stack, which Fortran had not used prior to that. And we made something that would call itself, but we didn't know what on earth to use it for. Very, very great lack of imagination. At Bell Labs, by the time I got there, they had just installed the 704, and they had tamed the Fortran stock book. They had, Dolores Ligas, single-handedly had taken all of the, found all the stops in Fortran and replaced them with calls to the system, which would print out what your stop was instead of having to read off the lights. The stop book was still there. But there was no manual intervention to find out why Fortran had stopped. And you would put jobs into the card reader stacked on top of each other. And the machine never stopped. Because Fortran used the entire memory of the machine, the operating system had to get out of the way when the compiler came in. And the way it got out of the way was the system copied itself out on the end of the magnetic tape, the current output tape, and then rewound over that record when the Fortran stop occurred and wrote real output on the output. I worked for Dick Hammond. He the Hamming Code, and also really quite one of the founders of the ACM, and really quite a visionary. Hamming, already in the late 50s, was telling everybody at Bell Labs that pretty soon, half of the budget of Bell Labs was going to go into computing. That's just Nick being his usual exaggerative self. And in fact, by about 1965, maybe 65, Hamming's prediction came true. By 1967, we had more space spinning on the disks in Bell Labs than we had shelf space in the library, in the company library. However, what was in the company library was more useful because nobody knew what the hell was on the disk. And it's really sorry that things haven't changed much in that regard. Maybe Google is helping us with our home retrieval systems, but librarians have used computers have learned much more computing than computing books have learned librarianship. Hemming insisted that everybody in Bell Labs would do its own programming. People told him it's going to waste a lot of machine time. And his theory was, no, it's better to have the right problem done the wrong way than the wrong problem done the right way. And if people do their own programming, they'll at least be solving the right problem. In the beginning, he also had the aphorism that is on the title page of his numerical analysis book. The purpose of computing is insight, not numbers. And the folks who program and make their own programs work often get a lot more insight about the problem than the folks who hand it off to a programmer and get an answer back. There were, in fact, plenty of programmers at Bell Labs. There had been a job title in the company. I don't know what the official job title was, but it was known as computers. And these folks all had degrees in mathematics, but they were women, and they got to run the desk calculators. When computers came in, they learned first how to program, and they were, so women had a corner on the best programming techniques at that point. Probably the most, because people did their own programming, or at least had a programmer in their own group doing programming and worked very closely with them, they had to come and apply for computer time. It was free, but they had to apply for it. Every Friday afternoon, a bunch of us would get together and look over the job applications for the week. And this was just a fantastic way to get insight into what was going on in the company. There was one computer, everybody in the company had a computer, of all sorts of things. And for a newcomer to get put on to get into that Friday afternoon meeting, but I got a pretty good idea of what was going on in the labs as a whole. Also, the math department that owned the computer had a great source of little problems. And many times, particularly Marion Gray, a wonderful Scottish lady, would come in, she'd look at her, and she'd scratch on the back of her head, literally, and say, here's your answer. She's the only person I know who's ever thought, if you know the great work, Whitaker and Watson, of higher transcendental functions. Modern Analysis, I guess, is the name of the book. Published in 1902, it's still in print. She's the only person I know who's ever found an error in Whitaker and Watson. But one would find fascinating collaborations for the math department. And the math department survived on taking it washer to other parts of the labs. The most sophisticated users of computers for perhaps the first 15 years of computing were folks in visual and acoustics research. They immediately started doing signal processing digitally. The first compiler written at Bell Labs by Vysotsky, who in my mind, Vic Vysotsky, is the greatest unknown programmer in computing. Just an amazing guy. Published almost never. He and John Kelly wrote a thing called the Block Diagram Compiler, B-L-O-D-I, or the Bloody Compiler. Bloody described a digital simulation of an electrical circuit. It had amplifiers, delay lines, and transversal filters, and diodes. Adders. And you would put together the circuit you were interested in making and run a simulation. The simulation consisted of one grand loop that hit on that updated every element in the circuit simultaneously, because it's a circuit, of course, is running in parallel. Sample data systems, we call them now. The compiler had its principal diagnostic was because the input said this delay line output goes to that adder and takes an input from this amplifier. And each card listed a component and told its connections. The cards were then, the compiler sorted everything into one great big coherent loop and made a single loop. It had an important diagnostic was in this circuit somewhere there is a loop. This time we're talking a wire loop, not a programming loop. A wire loop that either consists of all delays or no delays, both of which are unphysical, and also, as a result, very hard to simulate. Vysotsky used to describe the language as the only programming language where you can take the deck of cards and throw it up the stairs and put the program back together in whatever order it came down, and it will still compile. I spoke of a lack of imagination on that day when we talked about what would happen if a program called itself. We had a similar one at Bell Labs. Doug Eastwood and I made a macro assembler. Macro was a thing that the word had been around computing since day zero. Everybody knew what it was, and very few people actually made them. George Mealy persuaded the two of us to do it, and it was just a great way to begin one's career. And the macro assemblers just spread throughout the company, and the ESSs, perhaps it even set back the electronic switching systems, because their macros were so good that they never had to develop a higher level switching language. And they were using them for the first 15 years or so. But one day, again, a group of us were sitting around and said, well, what would happen if one macro defined another? Vysotsky asked the question. I said, that's an interesting thing. Yeah, well, you could make a whole bunch of definitions that were similar. The definition for add was a substitution instance of the definition for subtract and multiply. Yeah, you could do that. Let's see if it works. Had to make a slight fix because the program wasn't reentrant. One rarely wrote reentrant code in those days. And made it work. Well, yep, and folks used it a bit. But we had a summer employee come to Bell Labs named Steve Johnson, who now works with Bill McKeon.
No, you work. I work for him.
You work for him.
Okay. No, he used to work for me. It didn't take long.
Steve Johnson was a high school student, and he jumped into this thing, and he saw what we had made. A macro definition is a piece of storage. Every time you put something in the definition, you store something away. And a call is a retrieval from storage, and the macros themselves do some kind of work on the data. So that we had unwittingly, well, partly wittingly because we had some conditional assembly, but we did not look on definitions as storage. We've made ourselves a general purpose stored program computer that ran at compile time. Once that insight, for which we had to thank a high school student, was about, some truly amazing things happened. John Folks managed to fit a 256 node network simulation in the 32K of memory on that machine. With incredible bit packing. And the bit packing was all automated by macros. And practically the first problem that simulation worked, it did another eye-opener for us. The telephone system depended on alternate routing. When you can't get a call through, there is always an alternate. And if the alternate doesn't work, there's a hierarchy. In New York calls White Plains, and White Plains calls I forget where, and they call Kansas City. And Kansas City was the root of the tree, and you could go back out. So there were three chances you had to get every call through. He ran some simulations of what happens in disaster, like the San Francisco earthquake that happened much later. Everybody's trying to call the same place in the country. And one alternate routing made things worse, which with hindsight is obvious. Alternate routing starts filling up every link of the network, even the ones that aren't going to San Francisco. And with the ethos of the telephone company, which was, the call will go through. It was a wrenching thing to turn the alternate routing into something that was load dependent. If the load was too high, it's a good idea to back off an alternate routing. That has nothing to do with computing, except it was an insight that came from computing. All the previous simulations, which Bell Labs have been doing since 1925, have been on such small examples that the phenomenon is uninteresting. I saw at Bell Labs a really historic machine. This is George Stibitz. And George Stibitz, how many people have seen the plaque in McNutt Hall administration building over here on the green? George Stibitz was an engineer at the labs, and in 1937 he had an idea that he could make a nice calculator, and he had another idea out of relays, which were what the telephone system was made of. And he said, And Shannon had just published his master's thesis, which talked about Boolean algebra applied to circuits. And he said, oh, I had a big AND and OR circuits, and out of that I can make a half adder, and I see how to build a calculator. And he went home and he built a couple of half adders as a proof on a breadboard on his kitchen table. That was it. That was the proof of concept for George Stivis's relay calculator.
Two relays?
George, what?
It looks like two relays.
Yes. Yeah. Well, these relays have multiple contacts in them.
Like multiple coils?
Yeah. Which is enough to do a half adder. He built a 10 decimal digit. Oh, and this was binary. And he said, binary is a neat idea because I can get by with less hardware. Well, when he started to design the calculator, he found that making the circuits to do binary to decimal output, which he thought he would need, was too hard. So he made a decimal machine. This decimal machine sat in the West Street building of Bell Laboratories. It had four remote terminals. You had to call up, and only one person could use it at a time. But there were teletypes, you could run the machine, and it did 10-digit complex arithmetic. Complex arithmetic was just what the computers have spent all their time on in those days, finding the poles and zeros filter response functions. In 1940, Stivis took one of his teletype machines to the summer math meetings at Dartmouth, and called in to set up a private line to West Street in New York, and demonstrated for the American Math Society desk calculator did complex arithmetic at 200 miles, almost more than 200 miles away.
What year?
So that's what the plaque is about, the demonstration of remote computing in 1940, before there were any computers. Stivis, I never had the good fortune to meet. He had retired before I got there, and where he retired to was Hanover. And he died 2 years before I got to Hanover, 90-something. And most of his retired life, he spent building special equipment, electronic equipment, for the medical department, the medical school. I've read some of his patents. They're great fun. He built a series of more automatic relay calculators after this complex calculator. And I saw the last one. It sat behind glass, and it looked like a central office. Just banks and banks of relays silently, quietly clicking away. Input was on paper tape, fed in through a teletype reader, and it was sort of like the card program calculator, except it had a patent. It had a patented idea. The transfer instruction, and on this machine, we mentioned the transfer instruction before. So what did this machine transfer to? Another teletype. So you put a different subroutine on. You put a whole row of teletypes in front of this machine, and a different subroutine in each one, in a paper tape loop. And you can do really remarkable programming. And this machine went into business, I think, around 47. And I saw it in 1953. They're still running now. It eventually went to India. In 1948, when the Smithsonian opened its computer exhibit, there wasn't a bit of stupid stuff left in the labs to find. They were all nutty, which is too bad. But this machine, when we got our IBM machine, it came with two customer engineers built in. And they were on call 24 hours a day. We had computer operators running, watching the machine all night. Stinnis' machine, the relay computer, they would load it up on Friday afternoon and stick all the jobs end to end on a paper tape. And this machine had an operating system in it. The operating system worked as follows. It read in, there was a symbol for here's the end of a job. It read into that symbol, doing whatever computations the job called for. If the computer, which was a calculator, which was highly self-checking, found it, did come up with an error, it would back up and try the job again. And if it failed a second time, which is just the way the telephone system works, if it failed a second time, it would go on to the next job. So there was this built-in operating system, and they would go away and leave jobs stacked up for the weekend and get the output on Monday morning. And same thing at night. They didn't have a night operator. So it was a backward step when the IBM machine came in. The IBM machine was a little bit faster. There were lots of interesting around 1960, IBM came out with another machine called the 709. Philco came out with a machine called the Philco 2000. The IBM machine was still built with those vacuum tubes. The Philco 2000 was built with transistors. What IBM had in their hip pocket, a transistor machine they were making for the government, for NSA. And they dusted off the electronics of that machine and the very dense memory, oil-cooled memory, and put together the 7090, sort of, overnight. And so we got one of those. We put a new operating system on it. The 709, 7090 had another innovation that first showed up at MIT. Namely, it had I/O channels that ran in parallel with the computer. And Ron Drummond, Gwen Hansen at Bell Labs set out to build an operating system for this machine before it arrived, and the system was running when the machine did arrive, that would do blocked and buffered I/O onto the mag tapes. And one would have a block of tapes that could contain a mixture of cards and printer lines. Beautiful job. We're using the I/O really as IBM obviously intended it to be used. It didn't work. The engineers had made this nice feature, but nobody in IBM had ever really used it, including interrupts. They had used it, but not using interrupts, which we did. And it turned out the interrupts just the logic was wrong. They didn't inhibit, as I recall, it was something about they didn't inhibit for long enough for you even to turn the interrupts off after getting one. We had to send it back. IBM fixed it very quickly for us. And this BESYS, was a really, really very good operating system. Ran at Bell Labs for years and years, even under the 360. When IBM came out with the disk drive another year later, we were the first people to allow people to leave their data on, give people so-called semi-permanent storage. You could actually leave some data on disk and have your own file system. This is John McCarthy, whom everybody has heard of. This is probably as a young professor at Dartmouth. He went to MIT from England. At Dartmouth, he invented the word artificial intelligence. Then he went to MIT, where he was a big pusher for timeshare. And now he's one of the grand old men of computing.
At Stanford.
What?
At Stanford.
At Stanford.
Yes. He gave a talk here a few months ago.
I missed it. The single most eye-opening hour of my computing life was when John McCarthy sent out an invitation to a bunch of friends scattered all over at MIT and elsewhere and said, such and such a day in 1959, I'm going to give a talk in room 2 something of MIT, and you might be interested. I went. He didn't tell us what he was going to talk about. In that one lecture, he went from Carr, Kutter, and Kantz. Three new words in computing, which were, in fact, referred to parts of the register on this IBM 704, the car and the footer, by the address and the decrement, contents of the address room and contents of the decrement of the register. And he introduced Lisp, and from car, footer, and cons, in the space of an hour, he built before our very eyes, a symbolic differentiation, ground zero. Suddenly, I knew what it meant, what a subroutine called itself. it was just a stunning contribution. Now, McCarthy gives credit to a language called IPL5. Which preceded Lisp. But IPL5 was a machine language without even good mnemonics. The mnemonics were like 1G02F3, like a Canadian zip code. that did do very nice recursive and backtrack programming, too. McCarthy saw hiding inside of that a really nice idea, and he boiled it down to Carpenter and Kantz. Computing hasn't been the same since. Everybody changed their approach. Algol came on the scene and pushed recursion. McCarthy was on the Algol committee. And about 12 years later, he got the Turing Award for it, and deserved very much deserved. McCarthy had several other ideas that also were. I was visiting MIT one day and I passed him in a car. And McCarthy said, "We got this great new idea, garbage collection." That's all he said. And that's all you needed to know. It really makes a difference what you call your invention. If you say garbage collection, anybody who has the slightest idea of the way this works says, oh, yeah, I can do that. It was a privilege to have known McCarthy as her productive years. Before I leave Bell Labs, tell more story about Bell Labs. Before I leave the pre-human stage, tell one more story about Bell Labs. I mentioned visual and acoustics research. And John Kelly, who was one of the designers of the Bloody Compiler, he was interested in artificial, synthetic speech. It was customary to put a loudspeaker on a computer. You would hook it up to the least significant bit of some register. He did the same at Whirlwind. And it would be crackling away in the background, the operators could hear it. And if the computer got in a loop, it would just scream. You know, you would let out. And the operator, if you had a program, you knew was going to do that, you would warn the operators, don't cut it, this is not a mistake. Well, one day, that white noise in the computer room, just out of the blue, said in a Texan accent, help, I'm in a loop. Help! I'm in a loop. This was John Kelly, who was a wonderful Texan, who had recorded his own voice and had cleverly arranged to tickle the registers on the machine just right to reproduce the sound. It just stunned the computer room. In the late 60s, from 64 on, MIT set out to revolutionize computing and make the computer utility that everybody was going to use. It's called Multics. Bell Labs joined forces with them. They went prospecting for somebody to sell them a nice computer, time-sharing computer. They wanted to have virtual memory, a nice idea that was invented in England. They went to IBM, and Gene Amdahl, the chief designer, said virtual memory is inefficient, I know better, you don't want it. Finally, MIT and Bell Labs went to GE, who said, you want it? We'll make it for you. By the time, and we got a thing called the 645 from GE. Meanwhile, in the back room at IBM, Gary Blau was making a thing called the 360 Model 67, which was a virtual memory machine. And IBM came out, and they dominated the field when they came out. But GE got there first and got the business of these things. Multics was a system that was going to end all systems. It was huge. There were 80 people on the project, whereas the operating systems have been built at Bell Labs and MIT before, having been by a handful of people at most. It was going to have virtual memory, segmented. The dynamic linking, the file system was actually turned on its head. The file system was the fundamental thing, and the I/O system simply used the file system. The file system were objects, we would call them today, each object being a computer segment, which could be dynamically linked together. it was a wonderful notion, and it did work, and it was used at MIT and Rome Air Force Base, but for a long time, but almost nowhere else. But it excited interest all over the world, and people started building these virtual memory time sharing systems right and left. It was a good project to be in, but it was big, lugubrious. In 5 years, it still wasn't big enough to handle more than a few users at a time on a $1 million piece of equipment. And Bell Labs pulled out. Two people working on the project were Ken Thompson and Dennis Ritchie. And Ken Thompson, and a third person, Rudd Kennedy. They've been off in a room occasionally saying, if you were building a file system, what would it look like? And Thompson had even decided, well, in the wee hours of the morning, I'll take that GE645 over myself and I'll build one. Well, he actually got it to Hello World status, but nothing more. And then the powers that be of Bell Labs said, we're spending all this rental and getting nothing from it. We're going to pull out of the project. This was a blessing in disguise, as you've probably heard. Ken Thompson founded a cast-off computer from the Visual and Acoustics Research Department. They had all this neat stuff. And a PDP-8 built a little system. Brian Kern had christened it Unix. And the world hasn't been the same since. And I, as department head at the time, muscled in and got to use this machine that these two guys had made. It only timeshared two users. It was just enough for Ken and Dennis. Well, I muscled in and got some. We had this GE635 in the basement, and it had big memory and big disks and all this, and floating point, and we had this tiny little PDP-8. And the PDP-8 is so much more fun to use. And the turnaround is so much better. I won't bore you with how we finally ended up getting PDP-11s, but we did. And folks came a-flocking to see. People got the word in Bell Labs that there was this neat thing. Somebody down in Charlotte, North Carolina, wondered if he could use it to schedule his workforce in a wire center. We monitors up here say your next job is to run a wire from here to there and push return when you're done. And since it cost nothing, it was a mini computer. There's a mini computer. This is probably not the first PDP-11, but this is typically what they were. Cost $20,000. Had telephones. Once we got this machine, we all got telephones, and we all got modems in our house and teletypes at home. At first, that wasn't too good because there wasn't any memory to protect. If you're a Unix user, you know what A.out means. Mostly, we gathered in this one big room, and everybody had his own terminal on this tiny time-sharing machine. And somebody would write a new program, and you'd holler, A.out! And that meant, I'm going to run a new program. You better save what you're doing. Well, I like crashing machines. We persuaded DEC to put in some primitive memory protection hardware, and we're off and running. Ken Thompson made a little language called B, based upon another language from England called CPL, based on another language from England called BCPL, based on another language from England called CPL, which we all called Christopher's programming language. It was actually the combined programming language of Oxford and Cambridge, like Christopher Strachey was central in it. And the great thing about CPL, it was never built, so it was you could always write the world's cleverest code in it because you could always invent a new feature. But BCPL was real. B was an extract of that made for this tiny little machine. It was an interpreter, and this is before this machine had virtual memory. They used disk as a backing store for the interpreter. So he could run big B programs on this machine. This was important. Things like the assembler he wrote in B. And they could assemble code bigger than the machine. Or when the assembler got too big, it could still run it on this little machine. He had software virtual memory. B was always typeless language. It had type in, and that's it. And the machine, of course, had bytes and bits, had bytes and words, and double words. And Dennis invented C, following on, and that everybody knows it just stuck. It really caught on. He hit a really sweet point in language design on that. He thought C was different every other week for a year as it got polished. And everybody was perfectly willing to throw out their old code and change to the new as it got better and better. The compiler itself got better and better. There was a constant. The first machine only had 24K of memory bytes, 16K for the operating system, 8K for the user. So the C compiler had to fit in 8K. And it kept growing as they put in new features. And if it grew, they would first put in a little more optimization to make the compiler shrink. And there's this constant race against the end of memory, putting in little optimizations so you can now put in a new feature. Berkeley Tague, who was outside of the Unix group, saw this thing and he said, "This is the best thing since sliced bread, and I'm going to set up a support group and support it throughout the company." So it really did spread to. It became the little system behind every telephone switch in the country that was doing things like gathering trouble reports, which were used to be put out on punch cards. Now they were gathered and analyzed online. And universities took it over, Columbia first, formed the Unix Interest Group, and now we're here today. Thompson and Ritchie were, which is Thompson, there was one year when at the end of the year I counted up how much code they had written and kept. They were the sort of people who rewrote often when they had a better idea. So I don't know how much they threw away. But between them, they wrote 100,000 lines of code a year. It's just incredibly productive. And very, very good code. Very clean, easy to read. Everything was small, and my heart sinks before Linux when I see the size of things. The same utilities that used to fit in 8K are meg now. And the manual page, which used to fit up, which used to really be a manual page, is now a small volume with 1,000 options. That was one thing. We used to sit around the Unix room saying, "What can we throw out? Why is there this option?" It's often because there's some deficiency in the basic design. You didn't really hit the right design point. Instead of putting in an option, figure out why you wanted what was forcing him to that option? This viewpoint, which was imposed partly because there was a very small hardware at the critic at the time everybody's perceptions were being developed, it has been lost, and we're not better off for it. I'm coming on the end of my time, so I'd like to tell one more Ken Thompson story. Ken Thompson got interested at some point in computer chess. And he started making chess programs, and we all thought, well, that's just sideline. But he recruited Joe Condon of the physics department. Together, they designed this machine. They built the hardware, they wired it on a homegrown automated wiring machine. They made it mostly out of PALs. It had three big components. One was a little PDP-11, which had an opening book. Thompson took a 35-volume opening book written on toilet paper in Yugoslavia and hand-entered it into the computer. The nice thing about that kind of data, though, it's self-corrected. Put it in the computer and ask the computer, is this a legal chess game? And it proofreads it for you. You never have to. There's a board where each of 64 squares is a little finite automaton. It can do move generations at a terrific rate. And finally, there's an associative memory for old board positions. The thing autonomously goes to follows out. Evaluates the tree of board positions to depth one. If you've got time, you then say do it to depth two. If you've got time, you say do it to depth three. In fact, you're redoing all that work. Doesn't matter because it's exponentially more work at each level. It slumps out all the previous ones. So it's very simple. So essentially, this is a one instruction machine, which is find the value of the board to depth so and so. After you found the value, you then actually try some moves and see which is the one that yields that value. It doesn't even tell you what the path to that value is. Very simple design, very effective. They made it in under a year. And just in time for the 1980 computer chess tournament in I think it was Vienna. It was in Europe. And it won that. And became also the first machine to actually attain chess master status. Thompson was just amazingly productive. And when I'd give him his annual raise, he'd say, "It's so much fun to work here. I hate to work here." That's the kind of guy you really like to have work. So reportedly working for you. Mm-hmm. Your job, as a boss, your entire job is to run interference for people like you. So I was lucky to have been in the right place at the right time with people like that. I certainly used up my allotted time, and I think I've come to the last few slides. It's been fun. thinking about how fun the last 50 years has been. I hope for the rest of you, the next 50 years is as much fun. Thanks.